So good morning, everyone, and welcome to this presentation of tenants course running over 2 weekends. Just a few logistics before we begin. The schedule for each day, I think, is posted outside, but just to briefly go through it so we have it sort of clear in our mind. So we've got 4 sessions each day, starting at 10 o'clock. The first session will go till 11:15. And then we'll have a 30-minute tea break. And then 11:45 till 12:45 will be the second session. And then we'll have lunch at 12:45 till 2 o'clock. So we've got an hour 15 for lunch. And then third session will be from 2 to 3. Again, afternoon tea break, 3 to 3:30. And then the fourth session, 3:30 to 4:30. So we'll be finishing at 4:30 each day. And in this program, we're going to be following this presentation of tenants text, which we'll start to look at shortly. But also, I want to sort of integrate that with practice, with meditation, because if it's only theory, then it doesn't really help us much. So I'm going to be trying to bringing it into practice as much as possible. So I hope to do a meditation in each session relating to this text. Also with this program, as all my programs that I run, I like to be very interactive. So we're not sort of like me giving a presentation and then at the end you have questions. So anytime during my presentation, if you have some questions or doubts about what we're talking about, please raise your hands and ask questions. So I like to be very interactive. So I think that's very helpful for everyone to be in that way. Now, I think you should all have the materials. There should be 2 handouts. The first one, of course, is the actual text we're following, the presentation of tenants. And as we can see from the front cover, it's the author of this text is Jetson Chögyi-Geltson, who lived in the 15th, 16th century. The reason we're using this text is that Jetson Chögyi-Geltson was the textbook writer for the Sarah J. Monastic College. And Sarah J. is one of the monastic colleges within the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. And so this centre, of course, FPMT Centre, is within the Gelug school, also having very close ties to this Sarah J. College. So that's why we're using this particular text, because there are a number of tenants' texts available that were written certainly within the various Tibetan traditions. But we're using this one because of that relationship. Also, I'll be using a little bit over this coming days. I'll be referring to this book a little bit, mostly, called Buddhist Philosophy, which is a translation and a little bit of commentary on another tenets text by Jungyam Shepa, another great Tibetan master. So I'll be referring to this a number of times over the coming days. And then a little bit, particularly in the next weekend, there's also this big, nice, fat book called The Maps of the Profound, which is also based on the same tenets text from Jungyam Shepa, but has a number of more extensive commentaries. And I probably won't use it very much this once or twice this weekend, but maybe in next weekends we'll refer to that a little bit more. But they're based on the same tenets text from Jungyam Shepa, so another great Tibetan master who wrote a very classic tenets text. And as I said, we're going to be breaking this tenets over 2 weekends. And as we're going to shortly see, these tenets, we have 4 philosophical schools that we're going to be looking at. And we're going to be looking at the first 2 of the 4 this weekend and then the second 2 next weekend. Just before I begin, just for my help, for helping me, how many of you sort of already have some sort of basic understanding of these 4 philosophical schools of Vaibhashika, Sautrantika, Chittamatra, and Majjhimika? How many of you already have some sort of understanding about that? Sort of kind of. Well, it's okay because I'm assuming no understanding. That's the basis I'm going from. So if you have no understanding, you hopefully won't get left behind. Because one of the main core elements in this tenets text, of course, is a discussion about the nature of reality. And generally in the Tibetan schools, when we sort of approach that, we only really talk about one sub-school within the Majjhimika system, that what's called Prasangika, which is next weekend topic, one of the next weekend. And there we only really talk about generally this idea of emptiness, everything lacks in inherent existence. And so the other philosophical schools, of course, have a slightly different idea about nature of reality. And as we're going to see, is that often we, when we approach the idea of nature of reality, we don't really go into these other schools hardly at all, if at all, which is a little bit unfortunate, because what we're going to see is that they're really like rungs of a ladder. They're like stepping stones to this Prasangika view of emptiness, which most of us who have studied it, we're quite eloquent in mouthing the words, you know, everything's empty of inherent nature, everything's empty of inherent existence. But when it comes to actually understanding what that really means, that's another story. And I think what you'll find is these other schools that we're going to be looking at can really help us to gain a better appreciation of what that really means. So that's one of the reasons we're going through these different systems. But before we start jumping into the discussion, I thought it might be nice to do a little short meditation just to relax the body, settle the mind, and setting a good motivation for the coming day. So if you'd like to find a nice comfortable posture. Allowing your awareness to descend into the body and simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And if you notice any areas of tightness or tension in any part of the body, then use the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension as best you can. And bringing your awareness to the area of your face and softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. The mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And at the same time, keeping the back nice and straight. and allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you can most easily notice any sensations associated with the breathing. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Now think of your motivation for attending this tenants weekend. And try to set the best possible motivation. And if possible, include others in your motivation. Not only motivated to attend for your own benefit, but also to be able to benefit others. And then keeping this motivation in mind, we can slowly end this meditation and begin our discussions together today. So we're looking at this presentation of tenants. And this word tenants here is a translation, the Tibetan word is drukta, and druk means like to accomplish, achieve, or to arrive at something, and ta means like limit. So drukta is accomplishing or arriving at a certain limit or a final position. So a tenant is basically coming to some sort of conclusion about something. But it's to the point where we really accept that this is the way it is, this is the truth. And there's a little quote from, I think, from this Buddhist philosophy book here that says, a proponent of tenets is not a person who is merely sympathetic with a certain position. It is a person who knows it to be correct and intends not to give it up. The question, of course, here from this is then, did the Buddha teach tenets? Did he teach these tenet systems? And the answer is sort of yes and no. No, he didn't actually sit down and say, okay, here are four tenet systems, I'm going to teach each one of them. Because the Buddha taught according to people's capacity. And so different people, he taught different things at the different levels. And it was out of these different teachings, then at a later time, then various Indian masters and Tibetan masters looked at all these various teachings and systematized all the various things that the Buddha taught into these various philosophical systems. So let's have a look at the history of how these various philosophical systems evolved. And we can, of course, go right back to the life story of the Buddha himself. Of course, he was born as Prince Siddhartha in 563 BC. And when he was born, it was prophesied that he would become either a great king or a great spiritual master. And so his father, who was the king, wanted him to follow in his footsteps, so he did everything he could to lead him in that direction. But then, as he was growing up, he came to really see the sort of the harsh realities of life. He saw aging, sickness, death, and he also saw wandering, holy man who really seemed to be very much content with his life. And so this led the prince to really decide that he really needed to find out the meaning of life, and so he had to actually escape from the palace. So he escaped when he was 29. He went out in search of the truth. And what happened next, I'd like to read the story as written in a book called What Makes You Not a Buddhist? Because he is from Tsongsa Khyentse. I think many of you know who Tsongsa Khyentse is. And he has a very nice way of describing the story, so I'd like to read that out briefly. He says, "Through many years of contemplation and penance, Siddhartha remained steadfast in his determination to find the root cause of suffering and to ease his own suffering and the suffering of others. He headed to Magadha in the heart of India to continue his meditation. Along the way, he met a grass seller named Sotya, who offered him a handful of kusha grass. Siddhartha recognized this as an auspicious sign. In ancient Indian culture, kusha grass was considered a cleansing substance. Instead of continuing his journey, he decided to stop and meditate right there. He found a place to sit on the flat stones under a nearby ficus religiosa tree, using the kusha grass as a mat. Silently he vowed, 'This body may rot, I may disintegrate into the dust, but until I find the answer, I will not rise.'" Actually, this story is depicted on that, I don't know what you would call it, plaque, that's it, plaque, thanks John. That plaque over there, we have these 12 plaques around here which are said to be the 12 deeds of the Buddha, and what we're describing now is this one here just to the right of the door there. So he's sitting underneath the Bodhi tree there, and it says here, "As Siddhartha sat in contemplation beneath the tree, he did not go unnoticed. Mara, the king of demons, heard Siddhartha's vow and sensed the strength of his resolve. Mara grew sleepless, for he knew that within Siddhartha existed the potential to throw his entire domain into chaos. Being a strategic warrior, he sent 5 of his most beautiful daughters to distract and seduce the prince." So I think you can see, I think at the bottom and top there's two young daughters there that are trying to seduce the prince. As the girls set out, they had full confidence in their seductive talents, but as they approached the meditating Siddhartha, their beauty began to vanish. They withered and aged, they grew warts, and a stench rose from their skin. Siddhartha did not stir. The dejected apsaras returned to their father, who was furious. "How dare anyone refuse his daughters?" In his rage, Mara summoned his retinue, a great army furnished with every imaginable weapon. Mara's army attacked in full force, but to their dismay, all the arrows, spears, stones, and catapults aimed at Siddhartha transformed into a rain of flowers as soon as they came within reach of their target. So I think you can also see in the middle there some of the demons trying to fire arrows and so forth at the meditating Prince Siddhartha. After many long hours of unsuccessful warfare, Mara and his army were exhausted and defeated. Finally, Mara came to Siddhartha and with all his diplomacy tried to talk him into giving up his quest. Siddhartha said he could not give up after all these lifetimes of trying. Mara asked, "How can we be so sure you have been struggling for so long?" Siddhartha answered, "I don't need validation. The earth is my witness." And with this, he touched the ground, the earth shook, and Mara evaporated into thin air. Thus, Siddhartha found liberation and became a Buddha. He had discovered the path to end suffering at its very root, not only for himself, but for all people. The place of his final battle against Mara is now called Bodh Gaya, and the tree under which he sat is called the Bodhi tree. This is the story that Buddhist mothers have told their children for many generations. And as we're going to shortly see, the Mara, the daughters, and the army are symbolic of three inner demons that the Prince Siddhartha vanquished to achieve enlightenment. And then, of course, after he achieved enlightenment at age 35, he went on to teach for 45 years, wandering around India, what he had discovered. And again, as I mentioned previously just now, he taught according to people's capacity. And often the various teachings he gave are grouped together in what are called the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And the first teaching that he actually gave, and that's the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, is the Four Noble Truths. So shortly after achieving enlightenment, he ended up going to Sarnath, which is very close to Varanasi. And there he taught the Four Noble Truths, which are the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And in describing the Four Noble Truths, often the analogy that's used is the analogy of a physical illness, and that the Buddha was like a doctor. That if we have some sort of physical illness, of course, generally we turn to the doctor, and what the first thing the doctor would do would to diagnose what is our current condition. And of course, a diagnosis has two parts. One is to first have a look at the symptoms that you're displaying, and then from those symptoms to try to work out what's the underlying illness. So these are the first two of the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth usually is translated as the truth of suffering. The Sanskrit and Pali word is dukkha. And often this leads to a lot of confusion because here we're talking about what is our current condition, you know, that we're in. And so often we hear people say within Buddhism that, you know, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering. And then often when we hear that, we think, well, that sounds a doesn't sound right. You know, sometimes I'm okay. You know, I have some pleasure and joy and happiness in my life. So I'm not suffering all the time. So here, what we need to be aware of is that this word dukkha has a much broader meaning than what we normally attribute to the word suffering. Because when we see the word suffering, for us that normally means some sort of unpleasant, painful, physical or mental experience. So, of course, the Buddha wasn't suggesting that our whole life is just that. And to really appreciate what this word dukkha means, and this is very hard to translate into English. I think there's no English word that really captures the meaning of dukkha. To really appreciate what that covers, we can talk about three types or three levels of dukkha. And the first one is called the dukkha of suffering, and this is actually talking about our unpleasant experiences. So that is part of the human condition, that sometimes we do in fact have unpleasant, painful physical, mental experiences. So that one's pretty easy to understand, that it's something we don't really want. Then the second type or level of dukkha is called the dukkha of change. And this is talking about our pleasant experiences. And of course, the Buddha used the word change here to highlight the fact that our pleasant experiences change. They come to an end. They're just temporary, transient experiences. But also that they are unreliable, meaning we can't just click our fingers and have one whenever we want. We need certain conditions to come together to have a pleasant experience. But also, these pleasant experiences are not even in the nature of happiness. happiness. Because if they were in the nature of happiness, the more that we would engage in them, the more happy we should become. But what we understand, of course, is that often if we overindulge in our pleasant experiences, they turn into suffering themselves. So by understanding our pleasant experiences in this way, we can simply appreciate that they're temporary, transient, pleasant experiences, that they are temporarily an improvement of a previous situation. But at the deepest level, what's underlying both of our unpleasant and pleasant experiences is what's called the all-pervasive dukkha. And this is really highlighting that at the deepest level, we're stuck in this state. That's what it means all-pervasive, is that means we can't really go anywhere or be anywhere to be completely free of the potential of suffering. And so dukkha, the word dukkha, encompasses all of those. So to avoid the confusion of thinking it means just unpleasant experiences, sometimes translators translate this as unsatisfactory. So if you were to hear that according to Buddhism, life, all life is unsatisfactory, then you might think, that might be true, let me think about that. Of course, it's unsatisfactory in terms of painful, unpleasant experiences. We could also say that it's unsatisfactory because our pleasant experiences don't last. But it would be unsatisfactory at the deepest level because there's always a potential for suffering to arise. So that's another word that's sometimes used. So this is part of the diagnosis, the condition that we find ourselves in. We find ourselves in this state of dukkha. And then, as with a diagnosis, the doctor would determine, well, what is the underlying illness that's causing this? Where is this coming from? So that's the second noble truth. The cause or origin of dukkha or suffering. And in the second noble truth, we can break that into two parts. There are two principal causes. Mental afflictions and actions. So the underlying cause is the mental afflictions. And here we can list many different mental afflictions, but if we sort of narrow in onto the main ones, then the main ones are often listed as what's called the three poisons. And these three poisons are the inner demons that we saw in that story from Prince Siddhartha meditating under the Bodhi tree. Is that the three inner demons, the first is ignorance, which is Mara himself. The daughters were, of course, symbolizing attachment. Sometimes this is translated as craving or desire, and then the other one, aversion, symbolized by the army. Sometimes instead of aversion here, you'll see something like anger or hatred, which is a specific form of aversion. So these are the three core mental afflictions that what we find is that actually ignorance is the underlying cause, the underlying mental affliction. And this ignorance here, of course, we can have many types of ignorance, but the one that we're mainly interested in here and that's being discussed in the tenets text in some detail is an ignorance with respect to the nature of reality, how we exist and the world around us exists. And then the four philosophical systems we're looking at go into detail about what does that look like. And it's on the basis of this misunderstanding of how we exist and the world around us exists
that leads to these two primary mental afflictions: attachment, wanting the pleasant one things, and aversion, trying to push away the unpleasant things. And then all the other mental afflictions come out of these. And that is driving our behaviour. And every action we do motivated by mental affliction has a result, has a consequence. And that result is our various experiences. So we're going to have a look at, a little bit later, we're going to have a look at how this process works. How do we get from this ignorance to our mental afflictions, to our actions, to our experiences of dukkha? So this is the first two noble truths, the diagnosis that the Buddha gave to us. Does anyone have any questions about anything so far? So remember, anytime you have any questions, just raise your hand and I'll try and clarify. Anything clear? Clear as mud? Well, hopefully we've sort of heard this a number of times already, so hopefully it's not brand new. I mean, this is the foundation of Buddhist teachings. Okay. So then the prognosis, of course, that's the diagnosis the Buddha gave. The prognosis was that we can be cured from this situation of dukkha by overcoming the cause, particularly this ignorance. So that's the third noble truth, truth of cessation. The ending of suffering and its causes. So the state of liberation from this condition of dukkha, of course, is called nirvana. Our cycling in this situation, in this state of dukkha, under the force of our mental afflictions and actions, this cycling is called samsara, Sanskrit word. So samsara and nirvana are not places. It's not like this is samsara and nirvana is somewhere we end up, some other reality we end up in. They are states of mind. So if our mind has mental afflictions, we're stuck in a state of samsara. Once we eliminate these mental afflictions and then the dukkha they produce, we are in a state of nirvana. So to have a look a little bit at this, we can have a look in your charts. The very first one, there's the two vehicles chart. And what we see is that the vehicle that can enable us to achieve this goal of nirvana is called Hinayana vehicle. Yana means vehicle, Hina means lesser or first vehicle. And this Hinayana vehicle that's coming from these Four Noble Truths teachings were transmitted in the Pali language. So usually within this level, we have the original in Pali texts. So we see that the goal of nirvana, which of course is a Sanskrit word, in Pali it's nibbana. When we achieve this goal of liberation from samsara, nirvana, we become what's called an arhat. But of course, to strive for that goal, we first need to develop the aspiration to be free. And to develop that aspiration, of course, we need to understand these first two noble truths. If we can understand that we're stuck in this state and that it's because of mental afflictions, and that we can actually eliminate these mental afflictions, then we can develop the aspiration for nirvana. And the aspiration here is often translated as renunciation. This is a little bit of a classic example of how terminology can be confusing. Because the original Sanskrit and Pali word doesn't really have the same meaning as the word we normally think of renunciation. Because for us, the word renunciation means to renounce something, to give up something. Whereas the original Sanskrit and Pali word doesn't really have that meaning. The Sanskrit word nisavana means to definitely emerge from. So it's It's this aspiration to emerge from samsara to the goal of nirvana. So this nisarana is really the mind intent on emerging from samsara to nirvana. So it's the mind intent on liberation from samsara. Whereas renunciation doesn't really have that direct meaning. And this, I think, was the term that was coined some years ago when Buddhism came to the West, and it sort of stuck. So when we see the word renunciation, we need to understand that actually it means the mind intent on liberation. And then on top of that, often when people see the word renunciation, often it's described that the entry point, because this is the entry point into the path to liberation, is developing this aspiration, is that to enter the Buddhist path, we have to renounce or give up what's called the eight worldly concerns. And then people think, oh, I'm not sure I want to become a Buddhist, because I have to give up, seems like I have to give up my money and pleasure and wealth and so forth to be a Buddhist. That's not true. When we talk about renouncing or giving up the eight worldly concerns, we're giving up the eight worldly concerns, not the eight worldly things. So it's not a matter of giving up money, pleasure, wealth, and so forth. It's about giving up an unhealthy attitude towards them, i.e. attachment, i.e. thinking that they're going to give us some genuine happiness. So that's what really renunciation is pointing to, is to give up this craving and attachment for money, pleasure, fame, and so forth, because they're not going to give you what you're looking for. So if we can give that up, but of course, then we're, as part of that aspiration, is to understand that the real source of happiness and suffering is coming from within. So that is the third noble truth, the fact that we can be liberated, we can achieve a healthy state. And then the fourth noble truth, truth of the path, is the path leading to the cessation of dukkha. So that is the medicine in the analogy. And so here we see in this two vehicles chart that the path or the practices, the medicine we need to engage in, is normally described here as the Noble Eightfold Path. So we see these eight practices that to engage in. And we can condense or group those into three areas of practice. That the, yeah.
Just on the renunciation, underneath you've got the other
Yeah.
No.
I think it has the. I'm not a Pali. I remember looking this up recently, but I think it has the same idea of the mind that wishes to emerge. It's not. It's not to do with karma. Yeah. So in these eightfold path, we can condense or can group the various practices into three areas of practice, which we see next to it, which are often called the three higher trainings. So right speech, right action, and right livelihood can be grouped under what's called ethics, or in Pali and Sanskrit, Shila. And the three middle practices, right effort, right mindfulness, concentration, can be condensed or subsumed into concentration, in Sanskrit and Pali, samadhi. And then right view and right thought can be condensed or subsumed into wisdom, in Sanskrit, prajna, in Pali, panya. So any of you, of course, who have done a Goenka Vipassana retreat know very well about this, because Goenkaji, when he's talking about what practices, what are the core practices in those retreat, he constantly mentions these three things, Shila Samadhi Panya, Shila Samadhi Panya, that these are the three core practices to engage in to achieve this liberation. Now here, the wisdom practice, or prajna in Sanskrit, or panya in Pali, sometimes we use a slightly different word to talk about the wisdom practice. and that is the word in Sanskrit vipassana, or in Pali vipassana. So in both of those words, the vi part of the word means higher or beyond, and passana or passana means to see. So vipassana practice or vipassana practice is seeing beyond, or superior seeing, or higher seeing, often translated into English as something like special insight or simply insight. And of course here we're talking about insight into reality, the nature of reality. And within this level of practice, based on the Four Noble Truths, when we talk about vipassana or the wisdom practice, we're talking about mainly gaining insight into three things, which are mentioned here in that last column, the three marks of existence. So we are trying to gain insight into these three things, and they're mentioned here briefly. The first is impermanence. In Sanskrit, of course, anitya. In Pali, anicca. And the second is suffering, which is the first noble truth of dukkha. And then the third insight is into no self, in Sanskrit anatman, or in Pali anatta. And no self here is the wisdom realizing is to come overcome the fundamental ignorance. So here in the Four Noble Truths, the fundamental ignorance that we are suffering from is we are grasping onto what's called a self. And the Sanskrit word for that is atman. And self here means an overinflated false sense of me. In all of these four philosophical systems that we're going to be looking at over these 2 weekends, none of them say there's no me, no person. So there's no Buddhist philosophical system that says the person, the me, does not exist. They're all interested in understanding how do we exist? How does the person exist? How do I exist? And they all say that we do not exist as this self, as this Atman, as this overinflated false sense way. So what that really means, we're going to look at, of course, in more detail when we come to that point in the text. But to keep it simple now, is that here in this level of practice based on the Four Noble Truths, the fundamental ignorance that we need to overcome to achieve liberation is to realize no self. Any questions? Again, what that really means, how we overinflate, we're going to look at, because there's a couple of levels of that we can talk about, at least three levels of falsely overinflating the sense of me. And we'll be looking at those at the various points. Just one or two more things, and then we'll look at how from the Four Noble Truths we end up with the first two philosophical systems that we're going to be looking at this weekend. And the first point is here, when we talk about the concentration practice, in Sanskrit and Pali is samadhi. So samadhi, we can talk about many levels of samadhi, many levels of concentration we can develop. Those of you who have more background within the Tibetan Buddhist system tradition, when we talk about this level of practice, the concentration practice, most commonly we hear about shamatha practice, translated into English as often as calm abiding. So normally in the Tibetan tradition, when we talk about this practice, you'll hear we're talking about shamatha practice or calm abiding practice. So shamatha is a particular level of samadhi. Whereas within the Theravada traditions, if you have a background in Theravada traditions, when we come to talk about concentration practice, usually you don't hear at all, hardly, about shamatha or calm abiding. You'll hear about dhyana practice. Jhana is another level of samadhi. So actually we can talk about 9 levels of samadhi. The first is shamatha. Then we, above that, we can talk about what's called the 4 dhyanas. And then above that, there's even 4 higher levels called samapatti, or absorptions, often translated in English. We're not going to go into these, of course, in any detail in this weekend, just as background information for you. Just so be aware that in certain traditions, they talk about dhyana and others shamatha. But in both of those cases, we're talking about developing a level of concentration as a basis for the wisdom practice, the Vipassana practice. And then within these here, this Vipassana practice, these 3 marks of existence, impermanence, of course, here means to realize things are changing moment by moment. And if we can really realize that, then that's going to very much reduce attachment and aversion. Because attachment and aversion can only really operate if we're seeing things as somewhat stable and static. It's very hard to have attachment or aversion if we're seeing the object as constantly changing. So by realizing impermanence, already the level of our attachment and aversion and mental afflictions will dramatically reduce. Then if we come to realize suffering or dukkha, that is going to be very instrumental in helping us to develop this renunciation, the entry point into the path to liberation. And then, of course, once we've developed this renunciation and we're striving for liberation, then if we realize this no self, anatman, we can eliminate ignorance and achieve liberation. And, of course, what this realization of no self really means, we're going to look at in quite some detail this weekend and also next weekend. So this is the vehicle that can help us to achieve the goal of liberation from samsara, the goal of nirvana. So these 4 noble truths teaching, this first turning of the wheel, then from that we have actually the first 2 philosophical systems evolving. And to briefly have a look at those, in your charts, towards the end, there's a chart called The History of the 4 Schools. It's one of the last charts. So what we see there is that the first school there is called Vaibhashika, sometimes translated into English as Great Exposition School. And with each of these 4 schools, we see that they have certain sub-schools within them. The Vaibhashika here, it says there are 18 sub-schools. The Vaibhashika philosophical system was the one that really first started to develop after the time of the Buddha. There were a number of what's called councils, where a number of arhats and so forth came together to really ratify the Buddha's teachings. And particularly, I think it was the second council, about 100 years after the time of the Buddha, there was a sort of a split there between 2 sort of groups. one called the Stuvaras and the other ones were called the Mahasamgikas. Don't worry about the names. But it was due to this split and a number of other splits that we actually ended up with these 18 sub-schools. And some of them are simply geographical, but a lot of them have slight variations in understanding. So the Vaibhashika school is simply an attempt to put all of these various groups within the same umbrella, because they're all following the Four Noble Truths teachings. So these 18 sub-schools, and there is some debate about, of course, how they formed and what they make up, but they were the first sort of schools of thought that arose after the time of the Buddha. And collectively they are called the Vaibhashika school. And that's the first philosophical system that we're going to be looking at. Also coming out of the Four Noble Truths teachings, the first turning of the wheel Dharma, we have the Sautrantika or Sutra school being formed. And this really started to evolve quite some time later. And we see that within the Sautrantika school, there are two sub-schools. The first one is called the Followers of Scripture, and the second is called the Followers of Reasoning. And the first sub-school are what's followers of Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, or Treasury of Manifest Knowledge. So this is a text that was written by Vasubandhu, and we see below the Vasubandhu's dates, he lived in around the 4th century, that this Sautrantika school really evolved primarily on the basis of this text that Vasubandhu wrote called Abhidharma Kosha. And then we have the Followers of Reasoning, another sub-school, who really started to evolve based on the works of Dharmakirti. And Dharmakirti was a great Indian master from the 7th century. And here he wrote 7 treatises on valid cognition. And so this school really evolved out of this. And in the, as we're going to see in Sautrantika school, one of the great parts of the Sautrantika school is the epistemology, is how we know things. So we're going to, when we look at Sautrantika school, there's quite an extensive presentation about valid cognition and so forth, how we know things and what's a valid mind and what's not a valid mind. So that's going to come up later. So then if we go back, there's another chart that I want to briefly look at towards the beginning, just after the Two Vehicles chart, the next chart, the Four Buddhist Tenet Systems chart. And here the 18 sub-schools are actually listed in a footnote if you're interested in knowing the names. But I want to look at the third column briefly before we go for a morning tea break, and that is proponent, the proponent of this school. So the proponent of Vaibhashika, it says, is a person propounding Hinayana tenets. So remember, Hinayana is the vehicle that can enable us to achieve the goal of personal liberation from samsara, the goal of nirvana. So a Vaibhashika proponent is a person propounding Hinayana tenets who does not accept self-cognition, but does accept truly existent external objects. Whereas the Sautrantika, it says, is a person propounding Hinayana tenets who asserts both self-cognition and truly existent external objects. So self-cognition is a thing that some of the four schools accept and some don't. And self-cognition is about how the mind knows itself. And just very briefly, what self-cognition is, the definition down there, it says it's a new and non-deceptive cognition that is free from conceptuality and is only inwardly directed and bears the aspect of apprehending subject. So what that means in simple words is that the schools that talk about self-cognition present self-cognition as a way of understanding how the mind knows itself. Because And it's a lot to do with the idea of remembering, that when we have an experience and we remember that later, we not only remember the object, but we remember that we remembered it. So how is it that we know that our own mind? And so for that, some schools say we need what's called a self-cognition, is that when we're apprehending an object, at the very same time, there's a part of the mind called self-cognition, which is apprehending the apprehender of the object. And that's how we know that. So some schools feel a need to posit this self-cognizer for that mechanism, whereas other schools do not. And we'll have a look at what, particularly when we look at the Prasangika school, we'll have a look at why they say we don't need to talk about a self-cognizer for this case. Metacognition is often used, or that often you find a parallel for that within Buddhism. There's a mental factor called introspection. So that's a little bit different than self-cognizer. And we'll sort of touch on that a little bit later. So often that metacognition is parallels with this mental factor called introspection. So that's something slightly different. But we'll hopefully clarify that when we get to this point later in the text. So what we're seeing here is that one of the basic differences between Vaibhashika and Sautrantika is that the Vaibhashika don't accept self-cognizer, whereas Sautrantika do. So again, we'll look at this self-cognizer a little bit later. But they're both the same in that they accept truly existent external objects, which means that for both the Sautrantika and Vaibhashika school, how the world appears to us is not a problem. That now there really does appear to be what's called truly existent external objects. Truly existent means existing in the same way in which it appears. For us now, everything that appears to us appears to exist independent of us. It appears to truly exist. And so in these two philosophical systems, they accept this, that things do exist in the way they appear. I.e., there's no problem with the way in which the world is appearing to us. The problem is how we see ourselves as a person. So for both of these schools, the fundamental ignorance that we're suffering from is grasping onto self, overinflating the sense of me and grasping onto what's called self. So we need to overcome this fundamental ignorance to achieve this liberation from samsara, to achieve nirvana. So again, both of these schools are saying that there are truly existent external worlds. That the world, there is an objective world there. No problem that. There's no problem there at all. The only problem is how we see ourselves as a person. Whereas next weekend, we're going to see in the second two schools called Cittamatra Madhyamika, they disagree with this. That both of those schools say, yes, there's a problem with how we see ourselves. We overinflate the sense of me, yes, for sure. But on top of that, how we see the world is also a problem. That the world does not exist as it appears. So that's one of the fundamental differences between the two schools we're looking at this weekend and the two schools we're going to look at next weekend. This weekend, the two schools, Vaibhashika Sautrantika, there is an objective world, no problem. The problem is only with respect to how we see ourselves as a person. Whereas in the Cittamatra Madhyamika philosophical system, how we see the world is also a problem. The world is not existing as it appears to us. How it really exists, of course, we're going to look at next weekend in some detail. So that's a brief introduction into the two philosophical systems we're going to be looking at this weekend. This, the last column, the illustration of person, we won't go into now, but we will be looking at that over this weekend and next weekend, because that's also a very important point, but that's coming. So any questions about this before we have a morning tea break? Let's have a tea break and come back in 30 minutes.